From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I call the phenomenon tomato troubles. You know, the yellow spotted foliage that falls off, or the plant that produces all those misshapen fruits. And yes, the attack of the hornworms too, when you wake up to a lot of missing leaves one day, or all of the above. August is a perfect time to check in with the tomato man himself, Craig LaHoulier, author of the book Epic Tomatoes, and see what we can do even under such high summer pressures to bring in that delicious harvest. So more in a moment, but first these messages.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com. Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook, Small Gift Books Illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now.
Craig LaHoulier gardens and grows tomatoes in Hendersonville, North Carolina, the last couple of years, after many years in Raleigh before that. He's a proponent of the straw bale gardening method, which he also wrote a book about. He's an avid canner of his fresh produce and teaches an online Epic Tomatoes course with his friend and mine, Joe Lample. I'm glad to welcome him back to the show just in time to save us all. Hi, Craig. How are you?
Hey, Margaret. How do I save myself? That's the question.
I know. Do you have the rescue squad on alert?
we have had a very, very unusual season here in Hendersonville. And so this is my third. And this was by far the most challenging, and I chalk it all up to Mother Nature was just not as beneficent with me as she was right. The last 2 years.
Right. The weather.
Yes.
Yeah. We're going to do a book giveaway of Epic Tomatoes with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com, so I just want to tell people about that. And so really, selfishly, I wanted to talk to you to commiserate, as we just started to do, because I could tell on your Instagram that even with your expertise and all your years of experience growing tomatoes, ambitiously growing tomatoes and breeding tomatoes and writing books about tomatoes, you know, you're still facing issues and even growing in straw bales.
Yeah, and there's some mysteries that have popped up this year that I need to investigate more fully, such as why are plants that are planted in virgin straw bales coming down with fusarium wilt, of all things, because fusarium is typically something that builds up in garden soil over years. So was it seed borne? Is there in fact an insect vector? So lots of things. Well, as you know, with every garden we have, there are mysteries to unwind and things to think about for the next year. But as you also can tell from my Instagram, there is no non-fun garden for the most part. You just roll with it and learn things, and there's always tomatoes to eat. So it's been a really good year.
Yeah, I loved on Instagram on your account when you put a picture of your straw bales and how what you just said, even though they were in this supposedly sterile medium, you know, or clean medium, not in soil with spores splashing up and so forth, that they were having trouble. And It as a comment to that picture, to that post, one commenter said, "That picture looks a lot like my yard, yellow, wilty, and still throwing out great tomatoes, a year in the life." And I thought, that person's got the they know.
Well, one of the things I've found useful and comforting is to just share what's happening and not gloss it over and pretend that it's not happening. I've been gardening 40 years, and I kind of have this thing that I think that in any 10-year period, maybe two gardens will be spectacular. Three or four gardens will be pretty good. And then you're going to get those one, two, or three mystifying defeats for the most part that just, and almost always it's due to weather. And of course, weather influences the onset of diseases and the presence of diseases and the different types of critters that comes in. So it's a very complex system with lots of variables that you and I and others get to have for our sandbox.
Yeah. Are there some tactics that, like growing in straw bales, which is one that has generally been a big advantage for you, a tactical decision that has benefited your harvests and healthier plants and all that kind of stuff. Are there other things like right now, when you start to see troubles, do you fastidiously remove discolored foliage? Or do you have other tactics that you are the must things?
Yeah, so there's the ideal and the must, and there is a direct dependency on your energy level that day and how many tomatoes you've already eaten. So what I find is the enthusiasm to get every spotted leaf and yellow leaf, et cetera, off the plant is really a high priority early in the season. And then the days get into the 90s and you've already canned so many different quarts. And so you leave some of those leaves on and you may not feed as often as you wish. And what happens is the plants say, well, thanks a lot, Craig. And they do what they do, which is the disease spreads quickly. So, you know, for things like septoria leaf spot, which are the small brown spots that start on the lower leaves, and it's just all around us. Septoria affects all of the tomato plant family, even the weeds, the Jimson weeds and such. So it's hard to avoid it. And it's hard to avoid early blight because that's in garden refuse that you may not clean up and in plants all around us. That blows in. And I had the perfect storm this year, like many have in the country, of conditions that lead to that, which is lots of 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock thunderstorms, which means you have foliage that is staying wet all night. And those spores, as soon as it calms down, are floating around and getting onto the leaves. So really appropriate spacing, making sure your plants are stress-free, plenty of watering, plenty of feeding when they need it, and then just being really vigilant to remove those first signs. So septoria and early blight will not kill a plant if you keep up with it. Fusarium is the bad one, and bacterial wilt, but I don't think we need to talk about that. That seems to be quite localized in different gardens, but it is also in the soil. Fusarium is, or verticillium, maybe more in the West, are the ones that really get people because they attack through the roots. And once a plant gets it, you walk out, it's wilting, even though it's well-watered, and then boom, it's turning bright yellow. That plant may give you a few tomatoes, but it's probably a goner. So that's the one disease, I think, that leads to the most depression amongst tomato enthusiasts.
Now, you mentioned feeding. And so let's just talk about, like, when do you feed your plants typically? Do you have like a protocol of when you feed? Because you're growing again in these bales.
Right.
So like if I were growing in the ground, what would be your sort of, if I'm growing in the ground, what would you be your sort of recommended feeding interval? And yeah.
Sure. So the amount I feed is really directly proportional to the amount that I'm having to water. And in the ground, I would say every 2 to 3 weeks, and then read the plants and see if they're flowering. Lots of flowers out there, and the plant looks nice and lush and green, you're on the right track. And, you know, use it maybe a general all-purpose balance fertilizer with NPK, you know, nitrogen, maybe a little more N earlier in the season to get the vegetative growth going, then a little bit more of the middle number. Phosphorus, you can switch to a higher phosphorus content later in the season, which promotes blossoms. But maybe 2 to 3 weeks, if you're not watering so much, maybe once a month in containers and straw bales. I'm going weekly because the heat is forcing me to water daily. And that daily watering is leading to nutrients leaching out a little bit more quickly. So I find the weekly feeding is working perfectly. I'm seeing, before the diseases hit, plenty of flowers, plenty of fruit set, and always going pretty well.
So, and you're using, it's a liquid, it's a diluted fertilizer of whichever brand you use,
but yeah.
a liquid feed we're talking
yeah,
about.
Just the tablespoon per gallon, mix it up in a big container. Yeah. I give each plant about a cup and a half a week, and the plants love it. They really, really respond to it. And you really need to do that in straw bales because there's no nutrients in a straw bale until you charge it up.
Right. And so when you take off, so we start, then we eventually start to see some infected leaves and so forth. When you take off that debris, where do you put it in your, I mean, do you remove it to a distance? Do you, you know what I mean? Like, what do you do with it?
Yeah. So I typically will fill up one of those big black plastic shrubbery buckets with it, go around and just either snap it off or clip it off. And once I get that full, I go way back into my woods and just dump it in a pile back there because garden debris, and you know, people who don't mulch, people who let their plants die off in the garden, they're going to see early blight and septoria more quickly because all of that debris may be harboring the spores and you get rain and it splashes that spore up onto your lower foliage. So this year is a testament to pretty much doing everything right and still having things come in. But, you know, my adage that goes along with this is since the 1850s, if you look in seed catalogs, we're being plagued by many of the same diseases that have been around for 170 years. And despite all of the research going on, we're still finding very few ways to battle them. So these are, they're a little bit like COVID. Well, they're very smart. And once you start hitting them with something or breeding varieties that are tolerant or resistant to one strain, what do? Well, we're going to develop ourselves into another strain that's going to escape it. So we're really fighting the Darwin battle here. Survival of the fittest and diseases are all a part of that.
Does keeping the plant, I mean, you stake, I believe, because you're in straw bales. So your plants are up in the air.
Yes.
And so is that another, that's another tactic for sort of good garden hygiene, right? Is that having them up in the air, not sprawling?
Well, you know, what staking does is it allows better air circulation, better sun exposure, and really less hiding places for critters, things like slugs and rats and squirrels to get under those plants. And also, if the diseases are in the ground, you have no contact of the leaves with the ground to aid in the transference of those disease spores onto the plants. The problem, of course, with staking is the plants get tall, they're indeterminate types, and one big windy thunderstorm will start, you know, the Leaning Tower of Pizza going on in your garden. I've actually had two plants go down. You know, and as much as we've talked about these diseases, I've, out of my maybe 25 plants in straw bales, I've removed half a dozen. So there are still plenty that are doing really well. So I'm now starting to think about, did the roots of the plants go through the straw bales into the soil? And could it have picked up some disease that was harbored in the lawn from me gardening the last 2 years? This is where you have to put on your Sherlock Holmes cap. And I do think about some of these diseases are absorbed into the seed coat. And even though you do fermentation, you dry your seeds nicely, you could have spores of things like fusarium or early blight and septoria sitting in the seed coats. And so they get into the plant, and once the conditions become right, which is heat and humidity, it can trigger them. So I've got a lot. When I say I've got a lot of things to figure out, and you know me well enough, Margaret, I've been doing this 40 years, and every year I still feel like, my gosh, I don't know anything about this. I have so much more I need to learn.
Yeah.
And then I like to share it with everyone, because it's no good to have knowledge unless you share it with your friends and other gardeners so we can all succeed together.
Yeah, well, that was what you and Joe have been doing on the Epic Tomatoes course that you had people that people subscribe to that started at the beginning of the season and so forth. Yeah.
Well, you know, you bring up Joe, and he and I have a combined 80 years of gardening experience. And and Joe will kill me if I say that, but it's true because he's only 39. How can that be?
Yeah, exactly. But
I was just at his garden. We did a blind tomato tasting. Man, was that fun.
I saw that on Instagram too. That was so fun.
It was fun, but his plants look a lot like my plants. So best laid plans of, you know, mice, men, critters, hornworms, and whatever, we're going to have issues. That really should affect people's, the numbers of plants people try to fit in. And this is kind of the war of attrition. If you only have three plants and they get hit by disease and you only harvest a few fruit, it's a lot different. I have 60 plants this year. So when I lose four or six plants, I'm like, well, I can still can all of these tomatoes. It's really not a tragedy. And of course, not everybody can fit that many plants, but go for as many as you can is always my advice.
You said slugs. You have slugs? You're having slugs? This is not something I have to say up here in zone 5, whatever. Normally everybody asks me about slugs all the time. And I just don't have, you know, I see a slug now and again, but it's never anything that I've lost a plant to of any kind. And I don't see a lot of slug damage on things. And mostly because I think I have a lot of good helpers. I'm infested with every amphibian you can imagine and a lot of reptiles too. And that's great, you know. And
lots of
good slug eaters over here.
My first year of the three, I've dealt with them. And again, I think it's the moisture and the wetness. I just replanted some squash plants and some bean plants last night because when I planted seeds, as soon as they germinated, the next morning, the slugs would have eaten them all. So now I've actually sunk little cups of beer, not a great beer. I'm a stout drinker. This was kind of a mediocre IPA. I figured the slugs aren't that fussy. But an hour after sinking those into the bales where they were level, each cup had about a dozen slugs. Yes, it's just insane. So
what oh my goodness.
And we had cucumbers and they were beautiful, full out of the season, but all of a sudden it looked like roads were drawn on them because slugs all night had traveled over the surface and just nibbled. So yeah, we've had no hornworms. We've had only a few stink bugs. We've had no fruit worms. This has been strangely the year of the slug more than anything else.
Right.
And it's just mystifying. I never thought they would like to be on straw bales because they're rough and abrasive. They don't mind at all.
Yeah. So just if you're not experiencing them, let's just quickly, you know, there's some of those, what I think of as like mechanical failures, you know, that aren't diseases or pests, right, but that, you know, because of like dry, wet extremes,
yes,
or something, plants get stressed out and things like you don't get any flowers for a while, or the flowers don't seem to get pollinated. You don't get fruit set,
right,
or you get these misshapen things. So
yeah,
just a couple of examples of like, what, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So these are the three main, what we refer to as physiological effects. So they're not the genetics of the plant so much. They are just the conditions that year, or they could be gardener operator error. And we'll talk about that. So the first is blossom end rot. And of course, everybody has seen it. It happens a lot on sauce tomatoes like Roma's where, oh, you're so excited. You've got all these tomatoes set in the plant, and then they all start developing a black sunken area on the bottom. And that is blossom end rot that really is brought on by an interruption in the normal calcium uptake of the plant because the plant has become stressed. And typically it will mean the person's been at work or they've had their back turned and the sun is out and it's 90 and the plant just visibly wilts. That stress level shown by the plant wilting is sufficient to interrupt the uptake of calcium, which creates the deficit, which leads to blossom end rot. So even watering, drip irrigation, being super vigilant. If you've got 90 to 95 degree days, go out at noon, give those plants an extra drink of water, and maybe minimize if you have a real problem with them in your zone, avoid some of the plum-shaped tomatoes and go maybe for more of the heart-shaped types because they're equally good for using in sauce, but they tend not to get blossom end rot as much as a San Marzano and a Roma.
Right.
So just keep your eye on the watering, mulch well. The other one, there's two that you mentioned. One of them is misshapen plant. Cat facing is another word for it. The ugly heirloom is another. And that is, that's where heirlooms got that moniker. And that is partially genetically controlled because those of us who love to grow the mortgage lifters, and the Cherokee purples and the big flavorful tomatoes are just going to have to understand that those flowers are going to pollinate in somewhat cooler conditions sometimes, or a condition that's not perfect, and you'll get a tomato that looks kind of funny. And I've grown to love the ugly heirloom. I roll with it. You know, you cut the bad parts off, you can the rest, you eat the rest, you save seeds from the rest. And the best way to minimize that actually is just to go with a rounder, more medium-sized tomato, because those big ones are almost invariably going to have a few fruit that you could enter in the state fair, you know, for the ugly tomato contest.
Right.
And I think the third thing you mentioned, which is really the most of concern these days for gardeners the world over who are growing in warm areas, is the effect of extended periods of heat and humidity on growing tomatoes. And there's two ways this is a problem. Under conditions where you're at 90 or above for extended periods of time, that pollen is really not going to move very well. The flowers aren't going to pollinate very well, and you'll have blossom drop. And this, you know, in the course Joe and I are doing a lot, most of the questions here are coming in about poor fruit set because so many places have been hot as ovens. So getting an electric toothbrush and just going at the base of the blossom cluster when the flowers just open and buzzing it for a few seconds, or flicking it with your finger, setting up a shade cloth so you can create a microclimate near those flowers that's just a few degrees cooler. The other thing is keep your plant healthy. Don't cut off all your suckers so that you have it flowering in several places on the plant all throughout the growing season, and you can overcome that. The one that worries me the most is pollen die-off. And when you get to temperatures 100, 105, 110, the pollen is actually going to be killed. And so, again, we have to think about tactics to lower a microclimate. I think we're going to see more high tunnel growing, more
Yes.
construction of greenhouses, more indoor hydroponics to try to escape the heat. So those are the three main things that plague gardeners that have nothing to do with the genetics, but just what the weather is doing to us at the moment.
Yeah. So you also mentioned, canning and so forth, and you love to cook, obviously, in with tomatoes. And you are a proponent of cold packing, of the old fashioned from the is it the ball? Who is it? The blue book, the
Yeah,
blue
the Ball
book
Blue Book. I love it. It's
recipe, right?
dog-eared. It's coming apart. And I learned something interesting about canning and where we moved to. We're at 2,500 feet now, and instead of doing a 45-minute hot water bath, we now have to do 55-minute to
Yes.
compensate for the fact that the water boils at a different temperature. My jam was coming out really funny because it took me a while to figure that out, or my yogurt,
Oh.
right? It affects a lot of things that
Yeah,
you're.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I cut the tomatoes into pieces. When I get to about 25 pounds, which it fills a bowl with a little bit of a bulge in the top, then I get my 7-quart jars out, wash them real well, tablespoon of lemon juice, teaspoon of salt, cold pack, hot water bath for 55 minutes. And I've had them last up to 2 years. I think in the last 3 years, we've canned 130 quarts, and we've had two that it didn't work out. And how we do it, you open when you go to use them, you open it, you smell it, and if it smells like fresh tomatoes, you're good. And if you have to pull your nose away because it smells really, really bad, your seal didn't work, or
Yeah.
the tomato that had a rotten part in it, don't even think of saving that. Just that goes into the compost bin or down the drain. There's a lot of anxiety about home canning. I think once you've got it and you understand the joy of reaching for a quart of homegrown tomatoes in the middle of winter and making a soup from it, it's worth the effort. And once you do it enough, it's really not even all that much effort. It's just what you do for the next few hours, you know?
Yeah. So in the last few minutes, I wanted to ask you to just sort of, I should have asked maybe at the beginning because people might not know, you once named a tomato. You've named other tomatoes since, but you named a tomato that's a very famous tomato. So tell us about that tomato and how it came to you and so forth. So which tomato are we talking about?
Oh, well, we're talking about Cherokee Purple, of course, which is
Right.
my, and I have to say this, we when Joe and I did our blind tasting, Cherokee Purple was included in the 15 that we tasted, and I had great anxiety because here's a tomato I've loved for decades, and I wondered how would it come out when we taste it blind. And Joe and I both rated it at blind tasted. Randomized, we both rated it at the top of the class. So
Good.
I'm not nervous anymore. So in 1990, I was participating in a lot of seed swaps, and a fellow from Tennessee named John Green, who's sadly since passed on, decided that I was the person he wanted to send this unnamed purple variety that he had. And he said it was given from the Cherokee Indians to the grandfather of a friend in the late 1800s. So I couldn't wait to grow it, and I did. And it had that unique color. And soon I looked at it and thought, oh, I hope this tastes good. And we tasted it, and it's like, yeah, it tastes good. So I sent it to Jeff McCormick of Southern Exposure Seed Exchange. I named it Cherokee Purple based on the info. Jeff called me. He said, that tomato's awful funny looking and awful ugly. I don't think people will ever want to grow it, but I'm going to offer it in my catalog in 1993 with a strong caveat saying only for the adventurous. And the rest is kind of history.
Yeah.
What I learned since then, I had a few phone calls with JD before he passed on many, many years ago. He received it from a woman named Jean Greenlee, who lived in Rutledge, Tennessee. Jean received it from her grandfather. So the actual location that it seems to originate from was near Sevierville, a town called Rutledge, and it is a Cherokee Nation area in the far eastern part of Tennessee. The one thing I'm kicking myself, and I could still do this, is to make a little road trip out there and see if I can dig up a little bit more information about this.
Huh.
Because, well, it's like typical genealogy, or
Yes,
our
yes.
grandparents, we didn't ask them all these questions we should have asked
Yes.
them before they passed on. So I'm in the same boat on lots of heirlooms. I am remiss and sad that I didn't dig further, but when you're young and you're excited about collecting all these heirlooms, you're just kind of looking ahead. I want to grow it and taste it and share it. And we don't have the maturity when we're young to think about what we should be doing in terms of obtaining information when we can.
Well, we're all glad that you introduced Cherokee Purple, even though Jeff McCormick thought it was ugly and for the adventurous. We're glad it's mainstream and everybody should grow it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what's cool, Margaret, is to understand how many adventurous growers there are now in the world.
Correct.
Because the fact that that tomato has caught on, in a way, was the sharp edge of the spear to separate people from this. I just want a red tomato in my garden.
Right.
And now people are growing a rainbow of colors
right.
and tomatoes in their
garden.
Right. That's all good news.
Yeah. So Craig LaHoulier, I'm so glad that we got to talk at the high season of tomato troubles, as I say. And we're going to have, as I said, the book giveaway of your epic tomatoes, a copy of that with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. And I hope I'll talk to you sooner than later again. And thanks for making time today. Now go back out and do more weeding.
one second to say, anybody who gets that book, if they email me at nctomatoman@gmail.com, I will send them a signed book plate to
oh, good.
To the book plus some seeds. And all they it, no, they just need to contact me and I'll get that off to them.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Well, I'll let you know who it is and I'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Such a pleasure. Thank you. You have a great day, Margaret.
You too.
Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook Small Gift Books Illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores
underwriting
now.
Support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners.
More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and tomato growing meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.